coming up in the My Ag Life Daily News Report. We hear from a young leader who was on the Ag Day call with CDFA Secretary Karen Ross. That's today's segment four. We also have today's news brief, but we start with the California water crisis. I'm your host, Sabrina Halverson, and joining me on the phone is Assemblymember Adam Gray, a Democrat who represents District 21, which is all of Merced County and part of Stanislaus County. Here's our call. I was reading the news release that you sent out about the water allocation cuts, and I wanted to talk with you about it because you said some very important things in here, I thought. And I'm a 40-year California resident, and we have seen so many problems with water throughout the years. My first question is, and I think it's a question on a lot of minds, is why isn't this fixed yet?
It is shocking. And despite the fact that I've seen it for almost a decade now in elected office, it continues to surprise me that a resource so critical to the well-being of our communities as well as our economy continues to just not really get addressed in a way that is sustainable for the future.
You pointed out, and there's a line in this news release that says, California's water infrastructure is so broken that we can suffer from severe flooding and drought in the same year. And that's true. How do we fix that?
We got to get water into the 21st century and start investing in infrastructure. And it's really what, it's really what's broken in government, both at the state level and frankly even at the federal level, is we have lived on the credit card of our grandparents' infrastructure, for 100 years. And we continue to not make the big investments that we need to have a sustainable future. And it's frankly, you asked why at the beginning of this conversation, politics. There's in fact inconvenient truths that people don't want to accept because they don't fit neatly into their respective ideological boxes. And we live in a period of time where there's just an abundance of, purity tests and self-righteousness on all sides of the political spectrum. And that includes, frankly, folks on the far extreme of the environmental movement that, frankly, have a religious point of view that we should, any investment in water storage comes at a cost to the environment, and we're just not going to do it. And, in the meantime, what they don't tell you is what that's going to mean in, loss of jobs, the loss of agriculture, certainly affecting the reliability of our food supply chain and just the general well-being of California, make us more reliant on food imported from other countries. All these things are realities, and not to mention communities that go without clean drinking water. I mean, it is immoral and outrageous that in the richest country in the world, in the largest state and one of the wealthiest states, we continue to have communities that go without clean drinking water. And that's just in 2021. It's just insane. But it's a direct result of people's unwillingness to, to accept the trade-offs and the compromise and frankly make the necessary financial investments, right? Let me just talk about that for a minute. I think one of the problems we see in, in our current culture is that so many people have lost faith in the ability of government to accomplish things, to build things, to get things done. And they've lost faith in many cases for good reason. You continue to, California's environmental laws, in many respects, have been pushed and drafted by people who are interested in kind of no growth, right? So the whole concept is to make things so costly and so time-consuming that it becomes impossible to build, and then subsequently the public loses faith and doesn't want to invest their money. I don't know. Do you ever watch the Bill Maher show?
I have seen it.
I'm not a big Bill Maher fan, but I occasionally flip on the show, and I know this in the past several months, every time you watch the Bill Maher show, he talks about the number of days that he's been trying to build solar at his home. And it's up to 1,100, it's been like 3 years or something. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that just becomes laughable, right? And the Boston Big Dig, you know, our just complete inability to build big projects. And, of course, that brings to mind the fact that in 2014, you know, I was one of the key architects of the water bond in the legislature and working with my colleagues to get that on the ballot and with Governor Brown. And at that time, we had a handshake and an agreement with both the legislative leadership and the governor that the San Joaquin Valley was going to get a temperance flood reservoir built as a result of that investment of some billions of dollars. And here we are in 2021, and we haven't broken ground, and the investment hasn't been made. And that's equally true for another project that was agreed to in that bond, which is Sites Reservoir north of Sacramento, right? So even the one bright spot, which was passing a water bond and getting a significant amount of money invested in infrastructure, hasn't meant a thing 7 years later.
Right.
Sorry for the long answer, but I'm passionate about that subject.
Yeah, absolutely. So am I. I know that you deal with the state, but in federal government, I've been reporting for years on agriculture and on the USDA and the Secretary of Agriculture, and we hear a lot about infrastructure nationwide. They talk about nationwide infrastructure improvements that need to happen, and we hear about broadband, and broadband's important. But what we don't hear a lot, or at least I'm not hearing a lot on the federal level, is money for California's infrastructure when it applies to water. Is there anything that can be done about that? And why do you think it's not on the federal radar as much as it probably should be?
Well, I'll view that through the lens of our congressional delegation here in the San Joaquin Valley. And certainly there's nobody who has more history or has fought harder for water than Congressman Jim Costa.
Yeah.
But outside of Jim, we don't really have anybody who's, done much in that space. And I think I'm going to bring it back to kind of the politics I was talking about, right? On the conservative side of California in our country, conservatives get upset because of the great expense and what they see sometimes as inefficient or wasteful government spending on projects, the cost and the time, et cetera, the delay. They don't want to invest in those projects. And then on the far left, you've got people who specifically don't want to build infrastructure because they see infrastructure as a enemy of, the environment, right? And climate change and well-being. And so what you end up with at a time when the far right and the far left control far too much of our politics, is the only thing there's consensus on or agreement is doing nothing. Mm. Right? If we do nothing, the conservatives are happy. We do the same thing. The liberals are happy because we didn't build anything. And I think that has played itself out again and again in Congress. We don't have leaders. If you study my record, you'll find that it's one of a very centrist, consensus building approach, right? I have friends and enemies on both the left and the right. And I've not been afraid to criticize both sides of the aisle when they're wrong, right? But
right.
How many elected officials are in that space, right? Most of them just pander to the right or the left. And we've seen dysfunction in government. And I think that dysfunction has largely occurred over the last, 30 to 40 years. And it's certainly gotten to an all-time bad here in the last couple of years. But we really need, more rational, moderate voters to step up and send people to Congress that will step up on these issues. I mean, perfect example. I know Congressman Josh Harder and some others worked on some proposal last year, and they got, you know, $5 million or something for water storage, right? And they ran around and pandered about that as if that was going to do anything. And we got, you know, $3 billion or close to it in the water bond, and even that was a drop in the bucket for serious water storage investment, right?
Right.
So I mean, I just think that's a sign of just pandering and not being substantive. And I think that's a problem in Congress. You know, again, our senior congressman, Jim Kosser, is a sharp guy and knows water inside and out. But, you know, he's one of the few middle-of-the-road moderates left in the whole of Congress.
Bringing it back to the state level, as you pointed out, you have tried to push water issues for quite some time. And I've looked at your history of that. And as you even said in your statement, it has fallen on deaf ears. What is it that you wish your fellow legislators in California, and maybe it's the big city people, but what do you wish that they truly understood about our water situation?
Well, I wish they had an understanding of how bad the situation is, right? They don't, because at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, the large urban population centers in California always manage to get what they want, right? And they do that because our legislature is skewed in their favor. You know, there's, 25 or 30 or something members of the, you know, kind of LA delegation in the legislature. And, you know, they're gonna command the resources. And frankly, what I've seen is that they're not afraid to be hypocrites to do it. You know, San Francisco's going to get its water, and they're happy to leave everybody else behind, but they don't have a critical understanding of how, you know, the food that sits on their shelves at Whole Foods, where it comes from, and how that works, and what communities need to make happen. And, you know, if people, I guess my wish would be if people on both the left and the right could sit down and agree on the goal, right? Agree on the goal that want to have a sustainable, local food supply, that we want to continue to have the number one agricultural economy in the world, and that we're going to get the water we need to get that done, as well as support all the communities, both the large urban centers as well as the rural communities, and making sure they have clean drinking water and the resources they need to thrive. And if we could all sit down and agree on the goal, and then sit down and work through the creative ways. You know, when Governor Newsom first came in, I was certainly under the impression, and he certainly talked a lot about, you know, an innovative kind of 21st century reimagining of our water infrastructure, right? But unfortunately, we sit here, you know, a couple years later, and feels like even that stalled out again. Now, I guess in fairness to him, we can certainly say almost all of the government have been somewhat myopically focused on COVID and all of the associated ills around that and challenges. But we got to, you know, we've got to start agreeing on the goals that are supported widely by both parties and most Californians and Americans. And then we got to be willing to compromise to get there, right? We got to be willing to stop the selfish, narcissistic attitude that frankly urban, urban cities and communities and large cities around this country and in the state continue to kind of get everything they need as far as resources at everyone else's expense, and meanwhile enjoy the fruits of the labor of the folks that toil in rural communities to do many of the essential work and jobs that, you know, allow for those communities to prosper and be productive. So, again, a long answer, but I think we could get there. I think there's a lot of creative and innovative ways, but we got to be willing to spend some money and invest in our infrastructure, and we also have to make that fiscally possible, right? We can't continue to pass laws in this state that create a situation where Bill Maher is waiting for his solar 3 years later, or doing a public works project, whether it's a dam, a bridge, or a road, takes, you know, 15 years, right? We got to somehow find a way to both protect and preserve our environment, but also be efficient in the investments that we make.
Right.
Do you have any other comments, or is there anything else that you would like to add to this conversation?
Well, I'll say this. We are getting, $150 billion from the federal government as a result of the crisis our communities are facing with COVID-19. California, despite the fact that we've had this crisis, has record surpluses yet again because the stock market's been good and most of our taxes come from capital gains. And there's a lot of one-time money out there right now. And there's nothing more important or more critical to California's future than our water infrastructure. And with all of this one-time surplus money sitting around, you know, if not now, when, right? When can we make these investments? And so I would say, I would challenge our governor and our legislative leadership to actually step up to the plate and make some significant investments so that we don't have this ridiculous, water infrastructure where, again, we can suffer from floods and drought the same year, as we said at the beginning of this conversation.
Right, exactly.
All right, Assemblymember Gray, I know that you're busy. I do appreciate your time, so I want to thank you for your call.
Happy to talk to you, and best of luck.
Thank you again to Assemblymember Adam Gray. The water conversation will continue. If you want to be part of that conversation, you can email me, sabrina@myaglife.com. Our news brief is coming up next. We're back in less than 60 seconds.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Here's your news brief for today. You have a couple more weeks to apply for the Conservation Stewardship Program. California farmers, ranchers, and private forest land owners now have until April 7th to apply for the CSP and to be considered for 2021 funding. State conservationist for NRCS California, Carlos Suarez, says the department knows many sectors of the diverse agricultural economy are learning more about CSP and are excited about the opportunities. CSP offers payments and technical assistance to help producers maintain existing conservation systems and adopt additional conservation activities or enhancements. Existing stewardship payments will reflect current conservation activities. The higher the performance, the higher the payment. Enhancement payments may address resource concerns such as soil health, pollinators, changing weather patterns, western forest structure, efficient irrigation, rangeland health, and more. Farmers and ranchers need more public research funding to stay competitive globally. Michael Clements shares more on the need.
A new report commissioned jointly by Farm Journal Foundation and the American Farm Bureau Federation examines how more public spending on agricultural research is needed to meet the rising global demand for food. AFBF Congressional Relations Director Scott Bennett says there are five USDA agencies funded to conduct agricultural research and development.
The Agricultural Research Service, the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, the Forest Service, the Economic Research Service, and the National Agricultural Statistics Service. Between these five agencies, there's about $4.2 billion for agricultural research, compared to a similar $4.1 billion 11 years ago in 2010.
Bennett says the United States could lose its competitive advantage in agricultural production and exports because of stagnant public research funding.
Other countries are boosting their public investment in agriculture. China became the largest funder of public agricultural research and development globally in 2009, with their funding increasing significantly since then. India and Brazil have also recently increased their public agricultural research and development funding. It is imperative that we increase our public research so our farmers have the latest and greatest tools in order to feed the world.
Bennett says focusing research in six specific areas would best benefit farmers and ranchers.
Crop breeding, crop protection, animal health, animal disease, and foodborne illness. Fifth is climate research. And last but not least, food and agricultural supply chains. Shocks like COVID-19 expose vulnerabilities in our food systems. Research on handling of pandemics within the agricultural sector is currently very limited since they occur infrequently. More investment is needed to improve supply chain resilience.
Find the report at FB.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
The Environmental Protection Agency filed a brief with the Supreme Court that lays out its new position on the renewable fuel standard. A DTN report says the brief covered EPA's view of the scope and purpose of the RFS, stating that the three refiners who received RFS exemptions in 2017 and 2018 didn't qualify for them. The U.S. Court of Appeals in Denver ruled that the agency violated the law when it granted the exemptions during the Trump administration. The January 2020 ruling led biofuel groups to push the former administration to apply the ruling nationally. The EPA brief also says that few refiners would be eligible for extensions if the law is followed. The Trump EPA granted 88 small refinery exemptions between 2016 and 2020. The 10th Circuit Court remanded three exemptions granted to refiners in Oklahoma, Wyoming, and Utah. In February of this year, the Biden EPA reversed the previous administration's course and sided with the 10th Circuit Court's ruling. Also in the Supreme Court brief, the EPA says the exemptions program was put into the RFS as a, quote, bridge toward eventual compliance for small refineries. Funding applications are now being accepted for projects under an expanded approach within the USDA's Regional Conservation Partnership Program. Rod Bain explains.
Several farm landowners and natural resources conservation stakeholders have familiarity with the Agriculture Department's Regional Conservation Partnership Program, in existence since the 2014 Farm Bill.
It's done in partnership with a whole litany of organizations that see multiple landowners and how those multiple landowners can accomplish larger conservation objectives.
And as Natural Resources Conservation Service Deputy Chief Jimmy Bramblett explains,
through the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, we bring the technical and financial assistance of the Natural Resources Conservation Service to the table, and the partner brings their resources, both financial and technical expertise.
Currently, over 2,000 partners within RCPP are working together to implement ground-level conservation in geographic areas of consideration.
Through RCPP Classic, they basically bring a proposal to us. We redirect our technical assistance and financial assistance to those geographic landscapes to accelerate conservation investments, as it were. And the partners bring their resources to commingle with us. We continue to work one-on-one with those landowners.
In case you are wondering about that RCPP Classic reference, the deputy chief explains through the 2018 Farm Bill, another funding mechanism through the Regional Conservation Partnership Program was made available.
The new manifestation that we call AFA, Alternative Funding Arrangements.
This new offering gives greater flexibility to partners in developing innovative conservation approaches and strategies. He adds proposals to RCPP AFA projects are now being accepted.
The proposal deadline will be May the 28th. We'll have up to $75 million available for funding up to 15 projects.
With funding emphasis in areas such as climate smart agriculture and forestry. More details about the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, its alternative funding arrangements, and how applications can be submitted for this latest round of funding can be found online at www.nrcs.usda.gov. Scroll over the Programs tab, then click the link Farm Bill. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The USDA's Commodity Credit Corporation will not be buying and selling sugar under the Feedstock Flexibility Program for the 2020 crop year, which runs through September 30th of this year. The CCC is required by law every quarter to announce its estimates of sugar that the agency will purchase and sell under the Feedstock Flexibility Program based on crop and consumption forecasts. Federal law allows sugar processors to get loans from USDA with maturities of up to 9 months when the sugarcane or sugar beet harvest begins. On loan maturity, the sugar processor may repay the loan in full or forfeit the collateral sugar to USDA to satisfy the loan. Grimway Farms announced recently that David Bright has joined the team as Vice President of Marketing. Bright will direct marketing functions for all product lines at Grimway, including the Cal Organic Farms and Bunny Love brands, as well as the company's food service, industrial, and ingredients division. Grimway is based in Bakersfield and is the largest carrot producer in the world, as well as the largest organic vegetable producer in the USA. It sells carrots and more than 65 varieties of organic vegetables year-round. That's your news brief for today. When we come back, Ag Secretary Vilsack addresses the National Press Club. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack addressed the National Press Club on Friday and discussed several topics. Here's what he stated on climate change.
And finally, new markets. Now, that's an opportunity for us to take full advantage of the climate opportunity, not the climate challenge. There's a tendency, I think, at times to look at climate as solely something that is to be avoided, something that we are concerned about, that's going to cause some significant problems in the world. I want to look at it from an opportunity side. And I think for agriculture, it creates a whole host of new revenue streams that could potentially be created to assist and help farmers become more profitable. Paying farmers for sequestering carbon, paying farmers for capturing and reusing methane, allowing farmers to turn agricultural waste into a variety of different materials and chemicals and fabrics and fibers, all of which creates new revenue streams for farmers as well as jobs in rural communities. That's transforming the agricultural system and industry in this country, creating opportunities for all sized operations. Now, here's a concern, and here's why this is important. When we say build back better, today, 89.6% of farms in this country today do not generate the majority of income for their farmers from the farming operation. That means in nearly 90% of our farming operations, those farmers and those farm families have to have additional off-farm income. And it seems to me that we can't say that our system is working the way it should if nearly 90% of those who are engaged in it are not making the majority of the money that they need for their families from it. That's why it's going to be important for us to focus on more markets, better markets, and new markets. On the rural development side, we understand and appreciate that tragically, there's still roughly 380 counties in this country where millions of our fellow citizens live and have been living in persistent poverty for an extended period of time. In those counties, more than 10% of the population of those counties has lived at a poverty rate above 20% for more than 30 years. It's an extraordinary set of statistics that speak to the need for us to focus time and attention on persistently poor areas in this country and using the tools of the American Rescue Plan, of the Build Back Better effort on infrastructure that the president will announce at some point in time and hopefully Congress will pass, and on the utilization of USDA programs and policies designed to make sure that we're doing what we need to do to create the kind of partnerships and connections in those rural communities to begin turning that statistic around. to begin providing hope and opportunity for people who live in those persistently poor areas, while also doing the job in the balance of rural America. It's also an opportunity as well for us to recognize that regardless of what we might do in meeting the president's goal of a net zero emission agriculture by 2050, it won't necessarily impact and affect the overall climate effort by the United States if our forests continue to burn in horrific fires. That's why it's going to be necessary for us to focus time, attention, and resources, and significant resources, on rebuilding our forests, on maintaining and managing them better. That's going to require Congress to consider, as they look at infrastructure, not just gray infrastructure, but also green infrastructure, investing the resources that will allow us to do better forest management.
He also spoke about agricultural markets.
Better markets means open and transparent markets. The opportunity for us to have better price discovery, to have more competition, to have stricter enforcement of rules to make sure that farmers and producers are getting a fair shake in the market. It's fair to say that there are deep concerns about consolidation that's taken place in the agriculture industry and how that has impacted the bottom line for farmers. So that's something we at USDA are obviously going to be looking at with our partners at the Department of Justice and others, but we can also create new competition, particularly in the processing area. And we think that there are opportunities with the American Rescue Plan and some of the other tools that USDA has to create new processing facilities to make our food system more resilient from the disruptions that we've had recently, and also to provide more competition and to create that more open and transparent market.
Child nutrition was among the Ag Secretary's talking points.
Let me just spend a minute or two more on this issue of building back better and focusing on the issue of nutrition. When we talk at USDA about food, we're often talking about food safety and food insecurity. But we also need to talk about food and nutrition security, the ability for us to begin the process of improving the food that is available to our children and improving the choices that are available for all of us as we deal with the consequences of our current food system. Today, 71% of American adults are overweight or obese. 18.5% of our children are currently obese. The United States government, through the Medicare and Medicaid program, spends $160 billion every single year for the treatment of one disease, diabetes, a lot of which is connected to diet. If we could cut that diabetes rate in half, we could basically redirect those resources in a wide variety of needs across the United States. My budget at USDA is only roughly $140 to $150 billion. So we spend more on diabetes control and treatment than we do on the entire Department of Agriculture that impacts and affects every person who lives, works, and raises their family in rural America. So I think we have a challenge. Can we improve the choices and opportunities that our youngsters have in a variety of settings? Can we help those families who are struggling and receiving SNAP to be able to have the resources to ensure that they get decent food, nutritious food? Can we create an informed consumer so as they're making choices for themselves and their families, they're making healthy and solid choices? This means we have to establish in our programs meaningful benefits that actually do provide the help. We have to make sure that the benefits are conveniently available and used. We have to make sure that we figure out ways to incent the use and the selection of nutritious options. And we have to provide good information that people can rely on in making decisions for their families as we deal with this issue of nutrition insecurity.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. Coming up, we talk to a leading voice for California's young farmers and ranchers. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? ProMax is your number one solution. ProMax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. ProMax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/ProMax for more information.
Today Today we're highlighting a young farmer from Willows in Glynn County, Jocelyn Anderson, who we talked to during the American Farm Bureau Fusion Conference about her involvement. Today we learn more about her as she joins us on the phone. You are very involved in agriculture there in Willows. I know that you're involved with Farm Bureau, and you've become kind of a public face for agriculture in California for young people. I was surprised and happily surprised to see you on the call with California Ag Secretary Karen Ross last week for Ag Day. Tell me how that happened.
Yeah, so that was really exciting. I actually received an email from one of the staff members at California Farm Bureau who works in the policy division. And Karen Ross is somebody who had worked for her, had reached out asking if there was any young farmers that they thought would be interested in participating in a Zoom call. And Taylor reached out to me, and I was happy to be a part of it because it sounded like a really neat forum to be a part of, especially since they were using it to celebrate Ag Day on a virtual level since we still can't do it in person this year. And it was great to be able to talk with some different types of young farmers around the state and just be able to discuss the changes we've faced this year. And even though we all come from a little bit different type of ag, so for example, you know, one is has a farm stand up in Placerville, one has a small farm that's more of an urban farm, and then also the California FSA president and a girl who is from Cal Poly and in charge of one of the programs that has to do with ag down there. Even though we all come from separate places, we all had the underlying kind of same issues. So it was great to be able to discuss that and see how it linked together across all of agriculture.
And you, like I said, you've been pretty involved in getting other young people involved in agriculture and in speaking up about agriculture. What has that been like for you to try to encourage other young people to be so involved?
Yeah, it's great to be able to set an example of what you can do and how you can be an advocate for ag, even if you just start small by discussing it with people in your local community. If, you know, there's something your county's working on that your farm might need help with, it's a great way to get involved and a great way to bring your story and how your family farming story really affects what's going on with your family farm. It's great to be able to bring it to either a state level or even a national level and share that.
So I know from talking to you before, we talked about, you know, what your goals were when you were fresh out of high school. You didn't necessarily intend to be on the farm. So when you left high school and went into college, what did you think that you wanted to do?
Yeah, so I thought I wanted to be a teacher. I started teaching swim lessons when I was about 13. I was a swimmer my whole life, a competitive swimmer, and so that kind of went right along with what I was already doing daily for going over for swim practice. And so I had kind of been involved in, you know, teaching from a young age, and I have family members who are teachers or in the education field, so I thought that's definitely what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And when I went to Cal Poly, I was in their blended or their dual liberal studies program where I was able to obtain my liberal studies BA as well as my teaching credential in 4 years.
Nice. And what age group did you teach?
I taught first grade and kindergarten.
That's got to be a challenging age group.
Definitely. I learned a lot. I had great experience. I was a great teacher and I really enjoyed it at the time. I just, after being in it for several years, I knew that's not what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And I started to learn more and more about my family farm and grow closer with my dad as well, and knew that I wanted to eventually come back to the family farm one day.
So when you decided to go back to the farm and you started learning about it, what were some of the things that you were learning at first, and did it surprise you? Was even growing up as, you know, a farming family, were there things as you actually started to get your hands into the business that you were surprised by?
I say definitely. I always say I literally still learn something new every day from my dad. You know, he's been doing this since he was a kid and on our specific farm now for over 30 years. So I just feel like I learn something new every single day. It's, you know, I wanted to learn everything. So, you know, even down how to work on equipment and change oil on tractors and, you know, just even general stuff. I wanted to be able to start building an understanding of how everything worked from the bottom up. So for me, I kind of started just doing a little bit of everything, working closely with our other employees on the farm as well, and learning everything I can from my dad and trying to ask him questions so that I can eventually hold all the knowledge that he does from being in the field and specifically with almonds and walnuts for so long, and our walnut huller as well, because that's obviously a big operation when we get to harvest, and there's a lot of moving parts in it that go along with it. But just gaining that understanding, and there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of stuff to learn, but I love it.
Yeah. And so you mentioned almonds and walnuts and then the walnut huller. Is that, do you grow anything else, or does that encompass your business?
We do still have two small fields that we switch between corn and either winter wheat or triticale, just depending on the year. So we work with our local farmers and neighbors to, we don't have the equipment for that to harvest it and plant it. So we do, you know, have those still, but mainly it's almonds and walnuts.
As you are, you know, continuing in your career as a farmer, what do you hope for the future, and have you set any goals that you're planning on reaching?
Definitely. I hope for the future, definitely, obviously, to be still farming. I always say that, especially now with the big still farming campaign that has gone on over the past year with everything that happened with COVID. Mm-hmm. But also just to continue my involvement through advocacy and leadership. There's a couple more programs that I'd really like to apply for and complete eventually in the state of California, and just being as involved as possible. I think it's so important to have family farmers who are, you know, on the ground working on your family farm every day to also be able to represent, you know, in a boardroom or with leadership responsibilities and positions. And so, you know, for example, right now I'm the first vice chair of California Young Farmers and Ranchers. Hopefully next year I can move up into the chair position. My 2-year term for American Farm Bureau will end next year, and you can only do that once, but it's a great program, and I hope to pursue some more leadership opportunities with American Farm Bureau in the future, like the Partners in Advocacy Leadership class. And there's also California Ag Leadership is a great program too, and something I'd really like to apply for in the future. And then continue my involvement with California Farm Bureau and the Young Farmers and Ranchers program. And when I age out of Young Farmers and Ranchers, just go straight into California Farm Bureau. I really enjoy being a part of it and learning as much as I can about what's going on nationally and locally in the state with ag policy and how it will affect family farms. And I hope to just be able to continue being involved in that.
Is your dad really involved too? Or where did you get that drive? Because you've got such drive for leadership.
Yeah, my dad, he's been part of our local county farm bureau pretty much since I can remember, since I was little. So he's always been a director on our Glen County Farm Bureau board. But I think, you know, my drive for leadership just kind of comes from within. I know that I've been successful in it in the past, and I can be a really great speaker and advocate for farms. And so I don't want that talent to go to waste, you know, and I always say it's great to have representation from the field to the boardroom so that you cover kind of all your bases. And I just kind of went along with it. And, you know, my dad, he's been involved in Glen County Farm Bureau, like I said, as a director, but he doesn't like doing a ton of stuff like I do. So he's all for me taking on those positions.
Well, somebody has to do it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So with your desire originally to be a teacher and now being in so many different leadership positions, it sounds like that you really like to work with people and inspire people.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think there's a little bit of transition that comes over from teaching and being an educator, is that I can still, in a sense, do that in a way with being on leadership teams and working with California Farm Bureau and American Farm Bureau. You're constantly, as an advocate, educating others who may not know as much about farming or agriculture. And it's a great way to be able to communicate to them and kind of continue that education streak of helping others understand where you come from and the background of family farms and agriculture in general.
What have been some of the challenges that you have faced as you have become a farmer?
So there's a few different challenges. And I think that one, bringing in the next generation of farmers and ranchers is going to be huge for us to focus on, and being able to create a successful pathway, especially in California, for that next generation to come on. You know, we see this big separation in generations of farmers and ranchers, and being able to get the next generation of young farmers and ranchers involved, and especially involved on the advocacy or a leadership level, is going to be really important. Also, I think just making sure to continue working on keeping land and resources available for agriculture. You know, the community and the state needs to be able to also recognize the good thing we do and prioritize ag as such an important thing and a California resource. You know, we have 400 different commodities in California, 99% of our farms are family owned, and a majority of those are small family farms. So we want to really make sure to continue to work with the state of California and make sure we're telling our story on how diverse, inclusive, and empowering careers in ag can be. And then also just keeping an eye on the growing expectations and requirements of ag operations. Obviously, we've, you know, farming is hard, from labor to water issues. There's so much coming down, you know, on agriculture in the state of California, especially. So just making sure that, you know, we're out in front of all those issues. We're there to be a voice for ag and really driving this industry forward and making sure that agriculture has a fair chance in the future.
Thank you again, Jocelyn. That is our show for today. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. If you know of a farmer or a topic we should cover, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. From the JCS marketing team, thanks for listening.